Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The San Francisco Bay Area is getting ready and bracing for even more inequality and displacement. Several major Bay Area-based tech giants, including Uber, Lyft, and Pinterest, are expected to go public this year. Thousands of employees will become incredibly wealthy overnight. A recent New York Times piece says it all. When Uber and Airbnb go public, San Francisco will drown in millionaires. The piece quoted a high-end real estate agent telling a crowd of investors that in just 5 years, there will not be any single-family homes available in San Francisco for $1 to $3 million. Instead, he predicts that due to new money and low supply, prices for a home could soon climb to an average of $5 million. Meanwhile, the street-level drivers for Uber and Lyft and Postmates, delivery workers, are all contractors. They're not employees, so they are not entitled to buy into the IPO. In fact, their pay and their work situation continues to degrade. So joining us to talk about how this should be dealt with and what we can expect are three guests. San Francisco Supervisor Gordon Marr represents District 4. He has recently called for hearings on how IPOs affect housing prices, gentrification, traffic, and inequality. Supervisor Marr, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you for joining us. Jason Benlevy spent decades doing marketing communications for big tech companies. He is the author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Hi, Jason. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be here again.
Great to have you. And Edward Escobar drives for Uber and Lyft. He is the founder of the Alliance for Independent Workers. Hi, Edward. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. We reached out to Lyft, Postmates, and Airbnb, and they never responded to our requests. Slack, Pinterest, and Uber got back to us, but declined to join today's show or provide a statement. Supervisor Marr, I want to start off with you. I want to focus specifically on Uber and Lyft today. The California Public Utilities Commission is in charge of regulating Uber and Lyft. And I remember when the cars first hit the streets of San Francisco, I was thinking, why aren't these companies being regulated? Can you walk us through how that happened?
Rose, this is an example, I think, of a new industry, you know, that really developed right here in San Francisco, like a lot of new tech. You know, the tech sector is really driving a lot of brand new industries and disrupting, you know, existing industries, in this case, the taxi industry. And so I think the regulations, the steps that our public agency and our government takes to regulate these brand new industries can often be a step slow from the how the industry moves forward, and especially the tech-driven industries, which move so quickly to develop and really disrupt traditional industries. So I think that's sort of the bottom line here on why we've been struggling, I think, to be able to adequately regulate the Uber and Lyft and the shared ride industry.
Because now we have about 40,000 additional cars on the streets just in San Francisco. And we've done a lot of shows with Uber and Lyft drivers talking about how they struggle to make ends meet. They drive from all areas of California. They sleep in their cars sometimes 3 nights in a row, while high-level executives are becoming incredibly wealthy. And I'm struck because when I ask local politicians, why aren't you raising hell about this? They say, well, our hands are tied. It's up to the California PUC. And I say, yeah, but you could at least talk about it and say, you know what, California PUC, you need to do something about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in full agreement. And I just stepped into this role, I should say, as on the Board of Supervisors representing the Sunset District in San Francisco, coming from many years or decades as a community and labor advocate here in the city and the region. So previous work, the organizations that I've worked with, including many unions, labor unions, have been very outspoken about the need for stronger regulation, not just on Uber and Lyft and their industry, but other industries as well, including Airbnb.
Right.
I do want to point out, though, that as we're still struggling to address the the limitations that we have at the local level to regulate Uber and Lyft. One positive effort that moved forward recently was an effort to tax Uber and Lyft rides in San Francisco and to generate revenue that could address the traffic congestion problem. And so we were able to get a state bill passed in the last session that now would allow us to move forward with a tax on Uber and Lyft rides in San Francisco. That'll happen next year, I think, on the ballot.
Next November.
Yes, that's
okay,
right.
Okay, on the local ballot. Jason, you have a lot of experience in this field. Can you take us back to the time when Uber and Lyft started flooding the streets?
Sure.
And the California Public Utilities Commission
right.
did not do any regulation.
Right. Most of these services started as what they were calling a transportation network. So it was the idea of car sharing, originally with ones like Lyft, were that if you were going someplace, you'd notify the application using your phone where you were going, and if someone was going in the direction that you were happened to be going, you could share the ride, which is where the ride sharing came from. It wasn't the idea of having people who spent their occupation doing this. It was literally to share a ride. And then they started becoming businesses. So people started specifically turning themselves into freelance cab drivers. So they would spend all day doing this instead of just going – being someone who was taking a passenger along. It literally became a taxi. But it became an illegal taxi. It became a taxi that wasn't subject to any of the same rules. The drivers weren't checked out. They weren't subject to the safety rules. They didn't have the proper insurance. And so basically overnight we had an illegal taxi business starting. Now, it became a really compelling offering because you could just push a button and the car would show up, which is a pretty nice thing. And also it was cheaper than cabs. But it was cheaper than cabs because they're delivering rides for less than what it actually cost. That is, a taxi is probably pretty close to what it actually costs to have a driver drive a car with proper insurance, show up, and get you where you're supposed to go. Uber and Lyft didn't have that problem because they were being underwritten by a lot of venture capital. So even if a ride costs $5 and you're paying $2.50, that the rest of that is coming from venture capitalists, which you could say, great, they're underwriting my ride. Well, the problem is they're not going to do that forever. And the idea is to be predatory and to remove the taxi business from San Francisco, to make it impossible for anybody to operate as a taxi driver.
And we'll talk about just how that works, because I've been reading a lot of stories about the IPO saying that Lyft will be worth maybe $2 billion. The founders will become billionaires overnight, and yet they haven't turned a profit yet.
No.
So I'd love to find out how that is possible
right.
and how that works. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you, Edward, you were on our show maybe about 5 or 6 months ago talking about what it's like to drive for Uber and Lyft. Do you still drive for those two companies?
Yes, actually, I spend more time doing the advocacy and lobbying on behalf of gig workers and the rideshare drivers. So it does not allow for as much time, but we get all the feedback from everyone from all over the country and different parts of the world as well. So we are definitely in touch with what's going on beyond just San Francisco.
And we've seen all kinds of reports about how drivers struggle to make a minimum wage, how they work extremely long hours and sleep in their cars. What is it like for you and other drivers?
Well, whatever you've heard, it's a lot worse.
Worse.
Exactly. Much worse. And what you had said earlier about folks sleeping in their cars 3 nights, you should look at it 24/7.
Wow.
It's gotten that bad, definitely.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it's just because the situation, the way it's been set up, drivers are working more and more and making less and less. So it requires them, in order to survive, this is not succeeding. This is a surviving mode. For them to do that, then it requires for them to do what's necessary in order to pay those bills and continue to make it.
Now, Supervisor Marr, you need to leave in about 15 minutes, so I want to make sure we spend some time talking with you about the hearing you're calling for on how these IPOs affect housing prices I mean, in this New York Times piece, high-end real estate agents were basically telling investors a lot of money is going to be spent. People are going to have cash offers, and they are expecting that the price of homes will soon climb to about $5 million. You also want to look at gentrification. We've already seen so many people being forced out of the Bay Area, traffic and inequality. So tell us more about that.
Sure. You know, like I think like so many in our communities, in our city, I've been following the media frenzy about the tech IPO bonanza that's about to hit San Francisco. And, you know, really, you know, like a lot of people, I'm concerned about how the rapid influx of new wealth that will result from this is going to greatly worsen our existing crises in housing affordability, homelessness, and wealth inequality in our city and our region. And, you know, I believe very strongly that the tech companies going public in the tech sector overall have a responsibility to be good community partners and to work with us collaboratively to mitigate their impacts and support everyone else to be able to continue to live in our city and our communities. So so I have called for a hearing at City Hall or at the Board of Supervisors in City Hall to really look at what the potential impacts on our city are going to be, particularly around housing affordability and wealth inequality. But also I want to look at tax revenue to the city because, you know, as I think your listeners are well aware, the San Francisco city created tax breaks specifically to grow the tech sector in our city starting in 2011. And then in 2012, we started a transition away from a payroll tax as our primary business tax in San Francisco to a gross receipts tax, which is just fully phased in this year. And that was really a lot of that was driven by the tech sector's desire to minimize their tax contributions to our city.
That is Supervisor Gordon Marr. He represents District 4 in San Francisco, which includes the Sunset. He is a new supervisor. He came to politics as a community and labor advocate. And Supervisor Marr needs to leave in about 10 minutes. So if you have any questions or comments for Supervisor Marr about how you think politicians should deal with IPO wealth. I mean, we are pretty much guaranteed to see so much more inequality in the Bay Area and a lot more displacement because people are going to become millionaires and billionaires overnight. If I remember correctly, Twitter, when they went public, they created 1,400 millionaires overnight, right?
Right, about 1,400, yeah.
And that is Jason Benlevy. He spent decades doing marketing communications for big tech companies. He's the author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Edward Escobar drives for Uber and Lyft, and he is the founder of the Alliance for Independent Workers. This is an organization that regularly stands up for workers who drive for these companies and are still independent contractors. Jason, what do you think government should do? How do you think government should deal with this issue?
Well, the part that I really don't understand is how we wound up having taxis on our street that have absolutely no regulation. That is, how is it possible that anybody can go and pick up anybody in their car and have them as a paying customer when there is no rules governing it? You certainly would find yourself unable to start any other business in San Francisco without having that kind of licensure going on, especially when you know it involves liabilities. And the big problem of it is that all the externalities are turned over to the city. Putting 45,000 cars on the street of San Francisco slows everybody down, mm-hmm. especially muni. And it's not uncommon to see in the red zones that are muni-specific that there are Uber cars pulled in. And we have to get these people out of there because it slows down the buses. So I frankly don't understand why the city doesn't have the right to control what the traffic is in our city. I don't understand how they signed off to the state to allow this to happen. It's just mind-numbing.
Supervisor Marr, again, you're new to mm-hmm. the board. I mean, it'd be nice we can do a show with politicians who have a lot, mm-hmm. who are around once, you know, Uber and Lyft hit the road. But what would you say?
Well, I say that's something that I'm very committed to looking into more is how we can change the state regulatory framework on this new shared ride industry to allow more local authority to regulate it, because that it's really at the local level, especially in a city like San Francisco, where we're seeing severe impacts on traffic congestion and also on just the working conditions and labor standards for thousands of people working in the industry.
And what can the city do to try to deal with the massive inequality and the displacement that these IPOs, I mean, that will be a result from these IPOs? I mean, that's pretty mm-hmm. much guaranteed at this point, right?
And also I was thinking that, you know, we talk a lot about disruption, and the idea of disruption is that you get rid of some inefficient system that perhaps people were making too much money doing whatever the exercise was, so, and there's something more efficient that comes along. But in the case of taxis, we're not talking about businesses that were really giantly profitable in the first place, and that the drivers weren't exactly making a lot of money. So if you're talking about taking what is already a low-paid position and then disrupting it with something even lower, it's just a license for abuse.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that, although I would say that the hearing that we're going to be holding sometime in April is not really going to be focused so much on the labor conditions and the sort of the economics of the industry, but it's going to be more focused on the impacts of this influx of new wealth as a result of the IPOs, and particularly what that's going to mean for housing affordability and gentrification in our city. And so we're really going to be a bit more focused on the housing impacts of this. And I think, as listeners are well aware, the San Francisco and the Bay Area are already struggling with the worst housing affordability crisis in our history. Teachers, in a way, have become the face of the housing crisis in our city and our region, and they've spoken out about how difficult it is for them to afford to live in the communities that they are teaching in. In San Francisco and other cities, teachers not only cannot afford to buy a home, they can't afford to rent an apartment on their own. And often they have roommates, sometimes even sharing a bedroom in the most extreme situations, like in San Francisco. And we've seen the housing affordability crisis has really led teachers to go out on strike for higher salaries in Oakland, and threatened to do that in other cities, even like San Ramon and Dublin most recently.
We have a number of callers on the line. Before we get to call Supervisor Marr, you've requested that the city's comptroller and tax collector report on the impacts of these IPOs, focusing on what you're talking about: housing costs, gentrification, business tax revenues. Do we already have reports, I hope, looking at this issue?
You know, we actually don't, because we just, again, as I mentioned, we've gone through a transition from and a significant change in our business tax in San Francisco, really, and it was a result of advocacy by the tech sector in particular. Hmm. So prior to 2012, we had a 1.5% payroll tax in San Francisco. So we would have taxed the IPO wealth, stock compensation wealth, or payout to the employees at 1.5%. That's been phased out right now, and where we have a gross receipts tax. So I'm asking the controller's office to basically provide a projection on what that means in terms of lost revenue for the city.
Wow. Can I ask a question? On the gross receipts, is it for nationally or just for the revenue that occurs inside the city?
It's for revenue that occurs inside the city. I think for corporate corporations that are headquartered in San Francisco, there's also a formula to take into account that most of their revenue is national. So their tax, the gross receipts tax, is sort of factored a little bit differently than companies than a local business that is solely based in San Francisco. But again, the tax has shifted away from the 1.5 payroll tax that we had before, which would have actually taxed the stock compensation from the IPOs, to now gross receipts tax.
Well, we have got a number of callers on the line, and Supervisor Marr has to leave us in about 5 minutes. So why don't we take a few calls that are directly connected to Supervisor Marr and the hearing that he's calling for next month. Let's go to Deborah in San Francisco. Hi, Deborah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for bringing this to the forefront, because, quite frankly, I've had a literal years-long slow burn anger at the idea that the city, former city administrators and officials have allowed the Twitter tax break to not have its end of the bargain be enforceable through the city administrator's office. It was a giveaway that was where promises were made and there was no teeth for enforcement, and as a result the promises that the tech companies made to give back to the community were largely ignored. Mm-hmm. And there was so little contribution, so little benefit for that huge tax saving that I have, quite frankly, nurtured a tremendous resentment and got, I don't want to speak badly about the dead, but for Ed Lee to spend every Tuesday going around to each and every tech company to be supported by Ron Conway and the others that allowed this to occur at the deficit of the voter and also the people who were most needing to benefit, the ones who had the greatest need were left holding the bag, and the commission that was put forward by the city to oversight this, they had no teeth at all, there was no enforcement, and it was a joke. So, quite frankly, Jane Kim had it taken out on her, and I believe that a lot of people were very, very upset with Ed Lee for so obviously acquiescing. And quite frankly, and there's even resentment against the current
mayor. And Deborah, we have to let Supervisor Marr go soon. Do you have a question for him?
Yes, Supervisor Marr, how can you advertise this? How can I tell other people that have the same feelings as I do about this hearing so that we can come and speak about the importance of making the tech industry pay their fair share to equal, make a little bit of inequality in this city, even though it's so gross that it's never going to be made up for? How can we all participate?
Thank you, Deborah.
So unfortunately, I don't have the date set right now for the hearing. It'll be sometime later in April. Deborah, you and other listeners who are interested in participating in the hearing and sharing your perspectives can contact my office directly. You can call my office or send us an email, and we would certainly let about the hearing once it's set. And we'll also be publicizing that more broadly through social media and the press.
Thank you, Deborah. We have an email from Bernie who says the true villain here is San Francisco city government for not enforcing existing laws. From Google buses to Airbnb, Uber and Lyft, our elected officials time and again have allowed tech companies to openly break existing laws without the slightest reprimand and then change the laws to their own liking. Again, we should say that Supervisor Marr is new to City Hall. So he wasn't involved with the Twitter tax break or any of these other laws. But we do have to let you go in a minute, Supervisor Marr. Once you have this hearing, and you're probably going to get a huge response from the public and policy recommendations, what kind of solutions are you thinking about right now? And what could be done about this? This is like we've been talking about this for, I mean, I was around during the dot-com boom in the 90s, and it's like I feel like we keep talking, but we're not seeing major solutions to these problems.
Yeah, well, I would say, at least from my perspective, and I think for many of my colleagues on the new board of supervisors in San Francisco, and it's quite a new board, the majority of the members have either just joined this year or last year. We're very interested in exploring all options. Everything's going to be on the table as far as policy strategies that we can look at, looking at how we can tax stock compensation, payroll in the city, other types of progressive taxes to ensure that the tech sector is paying their fair share to mitigate their impacts. And I think we're also going to be looking at housing policies and how we could slow down or even turn back the housing speculation frenzy that this is driving, because it's not really targeted at the tech workers. I have fully appreciate the work that they're doing and they have the right to enjoy their livelihood and their life, But this is really looking at particularly this is driving the real estate sector in a frenzy in speculation and development in the city, not just in south of Market and the Mission, but we're really seeing that on the west side too, in the Sunset District where I live, which is historically modest single family homes now are being bought and flipped and totally developed, you know, to cater to the new wealthy.
Yeah, and it's a good point because we're talking really about the high-level executives who are about to become incredibly wealthy. I have a friend who works at Salesforce, and he does some really important things there, and he's not allowed to buy stocks. You know, people who make, I don't know, less than 200 grand, according to him, say, we can't buy stocks. We don't have access to that. So we're talking about the high-level executives. I did read that the Lyft CEOs will become billionaires once they go public. So it is important to make that distinction.
Yeah, exactly. And again, there's been a lot of media frenzy in covering this. I think, but the hearing that we're going to be holding is going to try to look at, you know, what the data shows and try to look at this issue from a rational perspective, and then see what the best sort of policy strategy we can pursue that would mitigate the impacts and ensure that everyone, you know, is able to continue to live in the city and in our communities.
Supervisor Gordon Marr represents District 4, which includes the Sunset. He is calling for hearings to look at how IPOs affect housing prices, gentrification, traffic, and inequality, and these hearings will happen next month. Supervisor Marr, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. And Jason, I just should say, you can buy stock as an average citizen, but when the company went public, they didn't share it with all of the employees.
Right.
How common is that?
Usually, if they're trying to defer compensation, if there's someone who they really want to have and they don't have enough money to pay them, what they'll do is they'll offer a participation in IPO shares, or, you know, a grant that they'll see when it's an IPO. And that's when they get to cash in and see a big payout. And a lot of times people take a very small salary in exchange for getting that promise when it goes to an IPO. And a lot of companies never get there, too.
We're going to take a quick break. Jason Benlevy is author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Edward Escobar drives for Uber and Lyft and is the founder of the Alliance for Independent Workers. We reached out to Lyft, Postmates, and Airbnb. They never responded to our requests. Slack, Pinterest, and Uber got back to us but declined to join today's show or provide a statement. This is your call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the Bay Area bracing for more inequality and displacement once companies like Uber, Lyft, and Pinterest go public. They're expected to go public in the coming months, and thousands of high-level executives will become incredibly wealthy overnight. If you'd like to join us, actually, we have full lines. We'll get to you in just a minute. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Jason Benlevy. He spent decades doing marketing communications for big tech. He's the author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Edward Escobar drives for Uber and Lyft and is the founder of the Alliance for Independent Workers. Edward, I wanted to ask you a question. And there have been a lot of lawsuits filed against Uber and Lyft over the classification of independent drivers. And once Uber and Lyft decided that they were going to go public, a lot of people said, well, wait a minute, what about the drivers that actually make you the money? You would not exist without drivers. So according to the Wall Street Journal, this is for Lyft. A Lyft driver who has taken 10,000 rides will get $1,000. So if you've driven 10,000 rides, you'll get $1,000 to buy stock. If you've logged 20,000 rides, you will get $10,000. What do you think of this, Edward?
Well, first of all, it's not realistic. They set the bar so high that it's very much unattainable by the bulk of their drivers. So it's very few folks that will be able to take advantage of it. That's a whole PR stunt that they did. And apparently it's gotten some traction for them, unfortunately. And that's detrimental to the drivers because the misperception that's being pushed out there to the public is that Lyft cares about their drivers, and they don't, nor does Uber.
Right.
And that is seen time and time again. But I think we really need to address the core problems here because I hear a lot of symptomatic discussion about issues. If we go to the core problems, the corporations are putting profits before people. That's the main issue here. And San Francisco has had a love affair with tech that needs to stop. This is abuse of the workforce exploitation, and they are empowering these corporations with their corporate greed to do severe damage that's causing human suffering. And this is on a grand scale. It's not just here. The cat was let out of the bag here, but this is like a virus that is spread globally, and people are being affected, impacted, and devastated across the globe. So we need to address core problems here. You mentioned one, misclassification of employment. Yes, this business model of Uber and Lyft is built upon an unsustainable misclassification of employment, which is exploitation of the workforce. That is being addressed presently. There is California State Assembly Bill that's number 5 that's being authored by Lorena Gonzalez. We need to support that. And this is addressing these issues, and it has the tech titans of Silicon Valley trembling. And they have created a fake grassroots sham organization coalition called the I'm Independent Coalition. And they are using that as a means of trying to get the politicians to steer things in their favor. They're saying, put it off, do not codify, because we need a chance to really look at this and evaluate. In the meantime, they're making billions and billions of dollars, and humans are suffering, and the exploitation of the workforce is getting worse. They are the heads of the snake, and other corporations are looking at their bad behavior and saying, look, they're doing this and getting away with it. Why not us?
Edward, what changes would you like to see for drivers?
Well, if we address the core problems, and that's misclassification of employment, then right there it'll revamp everything. And we take it back to zero and start the way it should have been done. As Mr. Ben Levy had stated, this has been allowed to happen. This unfair competition has given them this opportunity to undermine other forms of transportation that have been in place for some time, that have been regulated, and they've been regulated for a reason. And this has been proven to help public safety. And also, the transportation infrastructure cannot be oversaturated. So we're calling for a real cap, not like the cap in New York. We're talking, because the cap in New York was just a cap on the numbers of vehicles. Well, Uber and Lyft have cleverly found a way to work around that. So we need to have a real cap on the numbers of vehicles and drivers. So this needs to be addressed separately. And so this will prevent the oversaturation and this traffic congestion, which, if anyone is concerned about the environment on top of that, the carbon footprint is just off the charts.
Right.
So these are so many different issues that are happening, that if we do not allow them to have unlimited growth potential, it'll definitely put a realistic mark on their IPO. Right now, it's like, hey, the sky's the limit. And so invest in Uber and Lyft, and you can become a millionaire, maybe a billionaire as well. So join us in that exploitation of the workforce. No, we have to say no to that.
Well, and since you brought that up, here's where I'm confused, and maybe you can talk about this, Jason, and then Edward, you can also jump in here. Here's a headline from CNN just recently, yesterday actually. Lyft is losing a lot of money, and it might not turn a sizable profit until the year 2023. Okay, here's a lead from Bloomberg recently. Hiroshi Miki Mikitani, a Japanese retail billionaire who runs an e-commerce group, owns 13% of Lyft's Class A shares. That would be worth $2 billion if Lyft goes public, with a valuation in the middle of its anticipated range of $20 to $25 billion, according to calculations by Bloomberg. The stake held by Lyft's co-founders, John Zimmer, 34, a former Lehman Brothers analyst, and Logan Green, 35, is relatively small after multiple funding rounds. Lyft's chief executive officer holds shares probably worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Silicon Valley venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, a Lyft investor since 2013, owns 6% of Class A shares. So the question is, how are these guys, and it seems like they're all men for the most part, how are they going to reap hundreds of millions of dollars from Lyft going public
right.
when it's losing money and might not turn a profit until 2023.
Okay. Well, we have had an interesting evolution in capitalism over the past decades. The digital revolution started something that we have never seen before, which is rewarding companies that don't make money. What the process really involves, there's something called market cap, which is that if you take the total amount of shares of a company and multiply it times the share price, that's what the company is worth. So a company like Apple, if you took all the shares of Apple that exist and multiply them times the market price, that would give you the value of the company. And the value of the company would be something like short of $1 trillion at this point. But Apple, since its founding, is a company that made money every single time they went out. And because of that, they generate a profit. Now, in a lot of the new digital businesses, they don't generate a profit. Spotify spends more money for the music than they can take in revenue. Uber pays more money to get cars out on the street, even at paying people too little to do it than what it costs than they collect in revenue. But when they get to this idea of an IPO, it's all about the promise. And the promise is that this is the future, and this is the thing that you want to jump on. And so they will go and start converting their private equity. That is, that most of these companies start with private equity, and there'll be private investors that get involved in this. But the objective of the private investor is to leave the company as soon as it goes public. Hmm. That is, to go and turn that into a multiple of what they've invested. So if they put in $1 billion to own 10% of the company, well, when the company becomes worth more because it goes out on the public market, they'll have a multiple of, say, 10 times what they put in initially. So all of these venture capital firms are really there to turn a multiple of what that money is. And they are basically selling when other people, retail investors, first get the opportunity to buy. And the idea is to get up the excitement as much as possible so people buy into the promise. And in reality, most companies that go to an IPO have their stock drop after they hit the market.
So how would this guy, I'm still a little confused about this Hiroshi Miki Mikitani, if his 13% of Lyft could be worth $2 billion if it goes public. So he could feasibly, after it goes public, he could
dump all
cash
of it.
All out.
Right.
And he would have $2 billion in his bank
That's
account.
Right.
Okay. So then that money, even though Lyft is not profitable, that's coming from people who buy shares.
Exactly. It's two separate things. There's a company that operates on its own profit and loss, and then people betting on the company. So stocks are really a side bet on how the company is doing. So it's perception. And it used to be based on math. You know, it used to be the price earnings ratio. Mm-hmm. If a company made money, you wanted to own it because you'd get a dividend, or the company would be worth more over time as the stock grew in value. But since these companies really finance debt, and a lot of the investors, I mean, especially in the case of Uber, Goldman Sachs invested money, but did it as a convertible instrument. So what they basically did is loaned money to Uber at a very high interest rate, and that had the promise that if the company goes public, instead of having to pay back the money, they give them stock.
So how do these investment banks fare, and what will they get from this? Because according to courts, in October, the Wall Street Journal reported that Lyft chose JPMorgan Chase to lead its IPO with Credit Suisse Group and Jefferies Group.
Right. So they basically engage in a lot of services. So they charge them for listing the stock and for underwriting it, for doing the roadshow that'll go around the country or the world.
Right.
And it'll also what's really important in an IPO is that there's a lot of very wealthy investors on the very first day who are the underwriters for it. So it doesn't hit the market and there is no one buying it. It immediately goes into the accounts, gets purchased for the accounts of very, very wealthy individuals. You have to be invited to be part of the first part of the IPO. That is the first minute that it hits the market.
And the Motley Fool reported a couple days ago that Lyft is now in the final stretch of its IPO. It is on a roadshow. It's saying that its shares will be priced in a range of 62 to 68 per share, which would raise about $2 billion for
right.
the company.
Right. It'll raise $2 billion that for a percentage of the company that they will be selling off. The rest of the company will still be owned by the other investors.
Okay. So if all these investors cash out because they know that Lyft is not making a profit, right? So take your $2 billion and run is what they're going to do. Sarah has a question. When Lyft and Uber go public, the shareholders will demand profits. Does this mean that the cost of the rides will go up and become more similar to taxi fares?
And that's exactly the crux of it all. That is that once a company goes public, the books are public. That is that any investor can take a look at what they're spending and what their expenses are and how much they're taking in. Right now, as a private company, it's all hidden from view. But as soon as it becomes a public company, they have to show what they spend on labor. They have to show what they're spending on marketing. They have to show how much cash they have in the bank and how much revenue is coming in. So when that happens, they're either going to have to raise fares or push drivers even harder.
Because for the first time, that information will be public.
Today, it's not. We do know more or less that Uber loses $1 billion every quarter,
wow.
That it loses $4 billion every year, which is why they were so eager to keep bringing in more outside investors in order to cover that debt.
So when you say it's subsidized, if I take a Lyft line, for example, that means I share a car with two other people,
right,
from Golden Gate Park in San Francisco to the Embarcadero, which would be probably a $25 or $30 cab ride.
Right.
That sometimes it's $5,
right,
for Lyft.
Right.
And so what we're seeing for people who don't live in the area, a lot of people are not taking public transportation because for $2.50 more, you can get a ride for $5.
Right.
So that $5 is actually subsidized by venture capital.
Online, I don't know the exact math online, but on the regular service, it definitely costs more to have a car and driver dispatched to you, spending half of that time empty getting to you. Mm. Because we know the utilization on Uber is 50 or 60% of the time the cab is empty or the car is empty. And they are driving to get where they are. I know that for people who live in the outer sunset, they always talk about being frustrated about getting a cab to come out to them. And the reason why is because a cab has to drive there and spend all that time and is only getting paid for half of the time that they're going out to get you. So they get nothing for driving out to get you. They only get paid for the time that they're driving back.
So, Edward, as a driver for Uber and Lyft, you're also the founder of the Alliance for Independent Workers. What are you all saying right now? What's the conversation around the coming Uber and Lyft IPOs and how it will affect you?
Well, Uber and Lyft, they have very little interest in creating long-term value for investors or for drivers, for that matter. It's not sustainable. This IPO is a way for employees and early investors to cash out and leave people who buy this IPO holding the bag. It's that simple. They're not focused on sustainability issues or factors. And so one thing that we've not mentioned is self-driving, autonomous vehicle. That's supposed to be their silver bullet, magic bullet, whatever you want to call, but their savior. At the end of the day, it's to basically eliminate all drivers and have autonomous vehicles there. And that's right now they're trying to usher that in as soon as possible, even in the trucking industry.
The good news on that is that that's not going to be happening anytime soon.
That's what's being said, but we hear it from the actual tech folks that are in our vehicles that say otherwise.
Yeah.
So we don't believe that you wait for the problem to be fully entrenched and then you try to resolve it in a reactionary mode. That doesn't work. So we need to address this now to have the dialogue.
Right.
And that is part of the equation, because that's what they're selling and pitching to folks when it comes to investment possibilities for the future growth of these companies.
Right, but the only problem is that the picture being offered by the technologist on robocars are extremely rosy, and that what is missing in that equation is if say right now there's 45,000 people driving their cars around for Uber and Lyft in the city.
It's double that amount.
Okay.
More closely, yeah. That's
so,
the old number.
So imagine.
Double? Are you saying it's about 80,000?
Yes.
Could be. So imagine that they had to capitalize 80,000 robocars in the city, that they'd have to pay for 80,000 robocars in San Francisco, that they'd have to have people to fix 80,000 robocars, that they'd have to have someplace to put 80,000 cars. So right now, they've externalized the cost and taking care of the cars and paying for the cars to the drivers. But once they actually have to pay for all those robocars, and believe me, they are not going to be working very well when they ever do arrive.
And that's where their partnerships then with these automobile manufacturers, where they provide the hardware, which are the vehicles, and as you mentioned, the logistics around providing the repairs and everything else necessary, and they provide the brains. the software. That's where their focus is. So they have very little of the, of skin in the game, if you will.
Right. And actually, the guy from the CEO of Lyft had projected that we'd already be having the robocars taking over next year and that his profitability would be based on that.
Yeah, they were saying by 2022.
Yeah.
But see, with the autonomous vehicles, that number that you mentioned about 80,000 would drop significantly because they could run them 24/7. So there would be less of those vehicles. But, you know, if you're counting on public, I mean, as far as governmental regulatory agencies stepping in when it comes to public safety, we've already seen that they've fallen very short of the mark. Even Gordon Marr's commentary about they're still trying to figure this out, I'm sorry, 8 years plus later, the government should already know what's going on. When I spoke at the International Association of Transportation Regulators Conference in Philadelphia in September of last year, it's amazing that these gatekeepers that are there as regulators are not regulating. They're not doing their job. And when the CPUC says, you know what, we're hoping that they cooperate in the process, what's that? You're a regulator. You require and you demand that it be done or you enforce. And that's the end of the story. But that's how it's been loosey-goosey this whole time that's allowed the cat to get out of the bag and spread virally across the globe.
Edward, before we get to calls, people have been waiting patiently. You just mentioned that there are now about 80,000 cars on the roads in San Francisco. Where are you getting that number?
Well, this is from inside sources.
Okay. Well, hopefully some journalists will do some investigating because Joe Fitz at The Examiner said last time it was around 45, but that is an old number, so maybe I'll ping him.
All you have to do is be on the streets and you'll see that there are
that is very true.
Of vehicles on every block.
That's so true. Well, let's take a caller. Let's go to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Thank you for the show. I have a question because I'm not clear on this. Are the jobs that are created through Uber drivers and Lyft drivers part of the overall numbers for the new job creations for the country? And if that's true, and they're not, now we're creating, of course, more jobs that are, don't provide livable wages, as well as what happens to the collapse when the rates go up and the demand for the Uber drivers and Lyft drivers dramatically go down, plus any other problems that arise.
All right. Thank you, Robert. Edward?
Well, you know, when it comes to as far as the practical application in the real world of what you expect to happen to be fair, just, and equitable towards the drivers, you can't really apply any of that because the drivers are always getting the short end of the stick. You have to realize there's a high churn rate of drivers, high turnover. There's no driver retention, I mean, really to speak of. They say approximately 4% retention year over year when it comes to these drivers. So you can imagine that drivers, once they start driving and they see that it doesn't make dollars or cents, they're out the door immediately because it's not sustainable. And the math doesn't lie. You know, you can't go by this fuzzy logic that Uber and Lyft try to promote, because the reality is, at the end of the day, are you able to survive with the amount of money that you've made, yes or no? And we're finding that answer is no.
Wow. You know, Edward, again, we reached out to Lyft. They did not respond to our request. Uber got back to us but declined to join the show or provide a statement. I mean, we've reached out to these companies on a regular basis, and they just don't come on the show. And I'm wondering, given that you are founder of the Alliance for Independent Workers, have you been able to talk to any executives there? Because Dara Khosrowshahi, he left Expedia to run Uber. And according to reports, he got $200 million to leave Expedia. And once Uber goes public, he's going to add many millions onto that. So have you been able to talk to any of these executives about why drivers are still struggling to make ends meet?
We've had some executives, especially from Lyft, that have expressed interest, but then when we go to follow up as far as that contact, crickets, non-existent. So I think that they're legal on the inside, say no, just as they do not appear on your show. Same thing. I did want to address something earlier that Gordon Moore, Supervisor Moore, had stated about taxing Uber and Lyft. If they place that tax on the corporations directly and make them responsible, since they have brick and mortar locations, that may be something that may be viable. But as we've seen, congestion pricing in London, in New York, this is a tax. They're trying to implement this whole new congestion pricing, even in Los Angeles. So they're ushering this in, which is squeezing the drivers even more so. And so this congestion pricing, they're using it to build out the infrastructure for other transportation needs that they have, which is not addressing the issue of congestion, which, interestingly enough, came into being after Uber and Lyft came into the market.
Right. And we didn't have time to take Ariane, but she wanted to talk about how these cars spew a lot of greenhouse gases, and many times they're sitting idle, waiting for the next ride, and they're on the streets for hours at a day.
Right. 50% of the time empty.
Yeah, that's correct.
How much downtime, Edward?
Well, with oversaturation of the marketplace for drivers, geez, I mean, sometimes they're sitting at the airport and waiting hours.
And in taxi drivers, for sure. I took a taxi the other day, and the driver said, "You're my second ride, and I've been here for 5 hours," because taxi drivers and their pay has been cut in half.
Drivers are being driven into poverty, despair, and suicide.
Mm, that's right. Suicide in New York.
That's right.
Not just in New York. Those are the ones that are recorded.
Wow.
In San Francisco, even amongst the taxi drivers, there's been 8-plus deaths that have been related to overexhaustion. You know, and driving under workers' exhaustion, by the way, is worse than driving drunk. And that's what's happening.
Edward Escobar drives for Uber and Lyft, and he is the founder of the Alliance for Independent Workers. We will definitely follow this, Edward. We'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Ben-Levy spent decades doing marketing communications for big tech, and he's the author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Jason, thank you for coming in.
Good to be here.
Again, we reached out to Lyft, Postmates, and Airbnb. They never responded to our requests. Slack, Pinterest, and Uber got back to us. They declined to join today's show or provide a statement. Thanks to Andrew Stelter for producing today's show, and Shireen Adil for line producing, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
I was basically embarrassed of myself because there was things I needed to learn that I didn't learn.
Daryl Lester was part of a 1970s lawsuit that found California's special ed system discriminated against black students. Sound familiar? Come to Learning While Black on March 21st to share experiences and brainstorm improvements. Daryl will be there. RSVP at kalw.org.